I'm John Marty, and the topic tonight is, I used a fairly long title, so I will say it because I wanted to start from that. And the topic was the collapse of the public conscience, and the subtitle, government has moved away from policies and investments that strengthen communities as politicians increasingly appeal to the baser instincts in voters. And then the question, how do we rebuild a public or community conscience? And in taking a look at the title, I wanted to explain two things about it before starting. First of all, what I mean by appealing to the baser instincts are the greed, the lower instincts in human beings, the vengeance, the fear, instead of appealing to the higher instincts, the compassion, the generosity, the love, and so on from others. And the reason I think it's important to talk about who's appealing to what instincts in people is that the public does respond to leaders, whether they're political leaders or other forms of people. We do respond, not 100%. I've never seen anyone be effective at getting 100% of the people to follow them, and no matter what it is. But nevertheless, we as human beings do lead when we are led in various directions. And so if our leaders are appealing to the worst in us, we tend to respond with the worst in us rather than the best in us. What I mean by public or community conscience is not simply the sum total of your conscience and mine and everybody else in society averaged out, and that's what the conscience is. I think that's part of it. I think the individual conscience is part of the sum of all of us together, and our consciences are part of what I describe the community conscience as, but it's also more than that. I think many times we may feel, well, I personally would, and let's take the death penalty here for a minute, I personally like to see Tim McVeigh fry, but I don't know that we as a society ought to do that. Or I can understand, in other words, not just that the rest of us feel different than I do, but that I really feel, or we really feel, that as a people we should have a higher thing. So I think it is more than just adding up what the levels of conscience or whatever of each one of us is. And the first thing, because I've titled it The Collapse of Public Conscience, first I gotta try and make a case that it is, I'd say, weakening. I'm not sure if I'd say collapsed, but to start with that, you gotta say it was stronger before than it is now. And you and I know that things, there weren't the good old days. The bad things in society now were replaced with different harms that society did to people in the past. So it's not like we were starting at a high point and we're moving down. But I do really believe that we're having a conscience step backwards in the lack of concern for community. And let me give a couple examples to illustrate what I like to make as the point. Let's take the debate on welfare reform. I'm not sure it was just the Great Society in the 60s or the New Deal 30, 40 years earlier. I think it was a long-term thing that we as a public, and not always, the term public, I don't always mean government, but that we as a community, we as a society, had concern for people in need. And the question was, perhaps, how do we best help people in need get in control of their own lives? How do we help them become self-sufficient? How do we help people when they can't be self-sufficient? That was the concern. How can we best help them? Now the public debate is much more, do we have to help them, or why do we have to help them, or how little can we get by with helping them? Not how can we do a better job of it, but how can we avoid doing it? Let me suggest some other examples. The other night, during one of these kind of discussions, somebody pointed out in their community, there's a very strong senior organization, seniors, often seniors, this individual said AARP was involved, and I haven't seen that in my state, but I don't doubt that it can happen in various states, where you'll have a group of people, I don't have any kids in the public schools, and I'm not going to let you spend my tax money for public schools. So any voter referenda on school financing, vote against it. We don't have kids in the school. We don't care about the community schools. Whereas I think the public conscience, maybe, even though I don't have kids in school, even though I don't use this service, I still want to make sure that it's available because it helps and strengthens our whole community. I would also say, and this is again not new, but I sense in the last 15, 20 years a growing strength of some of the parochialism in terms of tax policy or other economic policies. In Minnesota legislature these years, we're fighting on how much of a road funding goes to rural Minnesota versus metropolitan communities because there are a lot more miles of road in greater Minnesota and a lot more people in metropolitan areas. So if you did it by who's paying the taxes, it would tend to be very heavily concentrated in one area, but instead it's been shared in the past, and now it's more, wait a minute, we got the majority of the votes, we want to take it for our turf. And that's not something new in politics by any means, but I think it's getting stronger. Or the so-called NIMBY syndrome, not in my backyard. Society has a lot of unpleasant facilities, unpleasant things such as power plants. People don't want the pollution, they don't want the noise, they don't want this. Not in my neighborhood. Yeah, we want it, but your backyard, not mine. And again, I mentioned crime earlier, and I'm gonna stick with this death penalty thing for a minute, to suggest in terms of how we've moved from what we may say is, how can we prevent crime? How can we intervene in some kid's life who's going astray and try and prevent them from getting worse? How can we rehabilitate a criminal? I mean, our prisons used to be, let's try and figure out how we can make sure people, they're correctional institutions, we still call them that. How can we convert people from the life of crime to becoming upstanding citizens? And we call it correctional facilities, not punishment facilities. And juveniles particularly, we've done that. And we're moving much more now. We don't talk about rehabilitating adults. We don't even talk about juveniles. We call them offenders now. We used to call them other sorts of things that were euphemisms that may suggest they're young people who have gone astray, who we're going to steer back onto the right course. Now we talk very much about, we're going to punish them the way we punish adults. And I would argue that death penalty is part of that vengeance attitude. This morning I was reading in Seattle paper about in Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge executioner, as he was called, Song Sen, was executed last week. And if you want to pick brutal people, Timothy McVeigh killing 168 people shocks us. The Khmer Rouge, this guy in charge of the killing, killed 2 million people over the past 20 years in brutal ways. Well, he got his due, as many people in our society would say, if he lived here. They executed him and his wife by shooting them apparently after having a truck or some other vehicle drive over and kill his 9 kids. Yeah. How do we do it? We torture him. We're going to make sure he suffers. Well, that wasn't... many people would love to see the same thing happen to Timothy McVeigh and other brutal people in this country. The reason I use that example from Cambodia is because the death penalty brings us down to the level of the killer. It wasn't actually the Cambodian government that executed him. It was the Khmer Rouge that he was part of because they thought he was a traitor or something now all of a sudden. And they were going to teach him a lesson, and a good lesson. And so we see how killers and brutal people, they kill their people in this punishment. And here we're being asked more and more to step down to that level, and the idea of understanding that these are human beings who have done some brutal things, it goes out the window because, again, politicians know. We can read the polls, and we know how to appeal to the fear, the revenge motives in people. And so I'm not sure that that's conclusive proof that the public conscience is going down. I think it is, as my personal read on it, but even if it's not, we're not in a very healthy state of affairs in terms of having a strong public conscience. Why is it weak, or why is it weakening, as I would argue? I'm going to give a number of arguments I hope we can discuss in more detail. This is certainly not a conclusive list, but I'd like to throw out a couple of reasons I think it's the case. So first of all, a public conscience, like individual conscience, is never a solid thing. Certainly a public with very diverse peoples, we're never going to have an incredibly solid community. At Holden Village, where we have a what we like to think of as a strong community, there are all kinds of arguments, there are all kinds of weaknesses in community conscience everywhere. And that's human nature. We have, as I said, positive instincts in each of us. We also have very negative human instincts in us. And starting from that fact that we have that weakness, there are all kinds of pressures appealing to the bad side of it. I'll suggest the number one pressure on that is the economic one. In order to sell products and services and products in society, in order to drive our economy, we try and sell things. And how do you sell them? You appeal to people's negative instincts. Buy this home security system to keep those dangerous thugs out of your home. Buy the club. It's the one thing law enforcement recommends to keep people out. Buy guns. You protect yourself. In terms of greed, you earned it. You deserve it. I mean, commercials more and more appeal directly to the fact you've worked hard. Now you deserve your chance to get ahead. And here's how you can show it. It's not keep up with the Joneses, it's overtake the Joneses. And again, our whole economy is driven by how much more can we consume and how much more can we use. So economic pressure is very great on that. And even in terms of us using it as opposed to stewardship for future generations, whether it's urban sprawl or whatever, home builders, developers, you can have this luxurious, in Minnesota, there's some communities now zoned for lots of no less than 5 acres. Talk about urban sprawl. It's incredible. We consume with no thought to the fact that, well, I earned it. I have a right to have a luxurious estate in the sprawling countryside. What about 2 generations from now, our grandkids or their grandkids or their grandkids? Well, we don't think about the fact that we're consuming all the wild, the wilderness or the natural lands, and we're paving it over for our houses and our pleasure. All of those economic pressures are driving us to look at our negative instincts, our lack of stewardship, our self-economic interest, our fear of others. Then on top of that, since I'm talking and the title dealt with the political appeals, politicians are doing it more than ever. I like to look back, pick a Minnesotan who's not around anymore, but Hubert Humphrey. Once upon a time, and people in some ways made fun of him, not made fun of him, but they perhaps joked in front of him about how he was, his nickname, the Happy Warrior, and certainly appealed to the good in people. Boy, by golly, we're good people. We're going to care about our seniors, and we're going to make sure they have this and so on. We care about them. That's a very direct appeal to the goodness and the generosity in people. We're going to do this. You guys want us to do this because you're good people and you really care about others. Look at how many more now is no new taxes, and don't let that government take away your money for some bad purpose. The appeals have switched very much in political terms, and I would suggest again that that is because politicians are able to read polls and we know what works. Hubert Humphrey was quite successful too. There were other politicians who have appealed to the goodness in people, and it has worked. It's a little simpler, perhaps, and perhaps more effective to appeal to the baser instincts instead of the positive ones. And that's, I mean, there's some ways we can have advertising in our society move in a way that encourages us to purchase things maybe not for our own sake, but for investing in other things where we would be spending money to help others. But politicians have very clearly turned very extensively to appealing to fear and greed and short-sightedness in people. The fourth cause I would point to would be a lack of a moral authority, or lack of moral authorities in society, which may be driven in part by our growing awareness a very positive growing awareness of diversity. We recognize we're not all the same. We don't all have the same histories, the same interests, come from different cultures, different races, different backgrounds. And we have to recognize and ought to recognize that. And that's very positive. But at the same time, that leads to a confusion. What are our common societal history? Where are our common bonds? Where do we have our community from? And therefore, who are our moral leaders? Who do we turn to? And I'm not sure if there's a case of nobody trying to step in there and fill that role, or if nobody's listening to them when they try and step in there and fill that role, or what exactly causes it. But I have a sense that we don't have as clear of a moral authority, and not necessarily one person, but perhaps the church was an institution that was a moral authority. Perhaps government served that way in some cases. And as we've had declining respect for governments, well, pre-Watergate, the presidency, even if the president himself was not a strong moral leader, the office held authority. The church has declining attendance, don't want to oversell that, but we have had people who we don't turn to the institutions or the people who have provided moral authority. Then two other things. One is a laziness or numbness, I'm not sure exactly what it is, about caring enough to learn about problems. It's too easy to not bother to find out what the community needs are, what the needs of others are. If it doesn't directly affect us, we don't bother to take the time even to learn about it. And the less we know about it, the easier it is to ignore it. And that's true of any problem, and that's not something new. That's just, again, human nature. We don't want to find out about some unpleasant things. And finally, and I'll point to the welfare debate again on this, there's been a growing awareness, accurate but exaggerated, that's been fostered by politicians, by the media, by others, that some of the community needs, some of the needs of others are caused by their weaknesses. Oh, these seniors who can't afford the heating bills. Ah, how come you see so many of them in these casinos gambling their money away? Or, I saw a welfare mother driving away in a Cadillac. I mean, that was a favorite Ronald Reagan line. You see the welfare mother in the Cadillac using food stamps. And, you know, there probably are some of those folks. But we use that as an excuse to not be concerned about community needs, about the needs of others. Well, if these, whether these are the causes or some of the main causes or not, is the weakness of our public conscience inevitable? Is there something we can do about it? I'd say very clearly, yes, there is something we can do about it, as long as there are, one, people of conscience, people who do care. And I think as a faith community, we recognize the importance of caring. And number two, not just people with consciences who care, but people with consciences who will be proactive and step out and intervene, instead of people who have the conscience and feel bad about it, but don't step out and do it. The other night when we had a forum on raising children, Sister Rosina was talking about intervening in a parent who was, a teenage parent who was doing a very poor job with a child who needed some love and attention, and intervening in a very awkward way when everybody else stands around and not sure what do. We don't want to interfere, but that's wrong and we want to do something. Well, you have to have a conscience that you use proactively to try and change it. So how do we do? What can we, as people who do care, what can we do to change it? I'll just give a couple of examples before opening it up for discussion and say that it's not they're wonderful, I don't know if it's billboards, I don't know who's doing it, but there's these billboards in Minnesota and I think nationwide, practice, commit random acts of kindness. And that's a nice theme. I mean, taking off on the random acts of violence and let's start doing random acts of kindness. But it's not just that, it's systematic acts of kindness. That's not just, oh, here and there, oh, I've read somewhere, I don't know whether it's in the advice columns or something, but somebody says how, oh yes, I just go out there and once a day I go out there and commit some random act of kindness, and boy, that's better than not doing one act a day, but it's kind of like the Boy Scout. I did my good deed for the day, and now we're off the hook. But we should be working systematically to find ways to be systematic acts of kindness, we want to call it that. First thing to do is care enough to care. We talk about public conscience, we talk about these issues because we care, we want to do something about it. Second is educating ourselves to learn the needs of others, to learn the needs of the public and the community. And when I say public and community, I mean it in multiple ways, including the stewardship of our resources for the future, stewardship for the next generation and future generations, in terms of individuals in our current society who are falling behind, in terms of how we strengthen us as a community who care about each other. The third thing, that after we've learned what the problems, what the needs are, is to do, and also at the same time to educate others in sharing and caring. And I think we all can think of plenty of ways on our own, but certainly I know as a parent, and most teachers know, they have to work at the fact they see a child in one of the kids in our son's class wrote a beautiful thing they had to write, who my hero was. And last year when they were in second grade, it was the kind of thing that makes a parent proud. He wrote, well, Mike is my hero because he's really nice and this and this. And it was a very moving thing. We saved it. The teacher sent us a copy of what this kid wrote because he named
our son. Tell him your son is Micah.
What?
Your son is Micah.
Yeah, our son. Mm-hmm. He named him. And this, we talked to them about it. And yes, this is a child who, I believe he does not live with his parents. I believe he lives with his grandparents. So I'm not sure the nature of his family situation. And it's a kid who needs friends. I'm not sure if he's unpopular or just lonely or whatever, but he certainly needs friends. And as parents and teachers and others who nurture children, we have to be helping them understand to reach out. We have to teach them the value of stewardship and sharing rather than ownership and I gotta have and possess. As coworkers in awkward situations, when we see somebody somebody doing something involving some form of bigotry, some sort of ridicule, some sort of negative behavior, that becomes very quickly the workplace environment to step in there. And even if we feel foolish doing it, try and change that. Certainly as politicians, don't go along with it. When we feel bad about what's happening, speak out. And yes, you do lose elections at times because of speaking out for unpopular causes, but that's why we should be in it in the first place. And I think one of the biggest areas where we have the most chance of persuading massive number of people are through the media, through the artists, through the people who write novels and television sitcoms, and the popular culture people. Both in trying to show a reality in the world, not a misguided impression, not the all welfare recipients are cheats and lazy people, but the people who will show realistic situations, and also modeling, people who will model positive sharing type of community behavior. That's basically our calling as Christians, to share, to care and share, and to spread the gospel to others. And before opening this up for discussion on all of this, because I think a lot of this could stand for a lot more expansion, whether our public conscience is declining as I think it is, or whether it's just not very positive right now and it's always been that way, that's dangerous. In a democracy, in any human civilization, we're a civilization because we get along, because we work together as a society. And if we let that decline and we keep appealing to the selfish instincts, it becomes everyone for themselves type of culture where we are looking out for number one, survival of the fittest. And there's always going to be some of that, but as we step down that road, I think we, the things that we've benefited from, the things where we are supposed to be a higher nature of being, we are losing that. So it is a critically important task that we look for ways in which we can build the community and the public conscience. And I'm not sure if there's any easy way to predict what's going to happen, but it's certainly an ongoing struggle and will remain an ongoing struggle. And I, with that, I'd like to open it up for whether throwing out other impressions about what's really happening in our society, whether it is getting worse or what might be causing it. I certainly would like to open it up for that.
I've got a comment just to, as, is it a symptom or maybe reinforces what you're saying? The gambling craze that has spread through the country in the last few years. It was not very long ago that most of us thought gambling was at least immoral. It was certainly illegal in most places. And now with the appeal to greed in all of us to get rich quick with no real effort on your part other than a few quarters in the slot machine, and the appeal to government to be able to find an easy solution for funding educational issues or whatever it happens to be with no consideration of the long-term consequences of gambling on society. It seems like that one thing to me kind of symbolizes where we are, the greed of getting rich yourself without thinking of the consequences to society.
That's a great illustration of it. I would agree with you on that. Minnesota is, we are one of the leading gambling states per capita. A couple years ago, we passed $5 billion in gambling, dollars gambled. Not, obviously, a lot of it comes back to the same person. But $5 billion gambled in a state of just over 4 million people, that's $1,200 a person. And frankly, Connie doesn't gamble that I know of. I don't gamble.
I
two kids.
My
somebody's gambling a whole lot of money. Minnesota, conservative Minnesota, is one of the leading per capita states in gambling. And it's been largely in the past 15 years that that's happened. And at the legislature, I served on the gaming, we don't call it gambling committee, on the gaming committee, it sounds more positive. I've watched every year they come in with some new form of gambling. This isn't an expansion of gambling. It's never an expansion, but it's expanding. And I actually carried a little amendment at one point to change what we call charitable gambling into lawful gambling, because our charities, as they call themselves, which include churches, include the Catholic Church does a lot of it, there are Lutheran churches that do it, there are VFWs and American Legion clubs and all sorts of others who have these pull tabs, and it's a big and growing industry, and I think about 5 cents on the dollar gambled actually goes into the charities, but which are more often ball club uniforms for teams than they are meeting other perhaps more pressing issues. But we've got that. Minnesota instituted a lottery about 8 or 9 years ago, and you hit both parts of it. One is it's new revenue for government, and oh, it's not taxing people, it's painless, we can do it that way. And the other part of it is the get-rich-quick thing. And the proponents of lotteries and other things keep telling us that well, you know, it's not really that regressive because, oh, middle-income people and even higher-income people, they gamble more than low-income people. Yes, in terms of total dollars, but in terms of percentage of income, they're using a little bit of excess to put in there. There are a whole lot of low-income people who put a lot in there. And it's certainly, it's appealing to greed. If you're successful or if you're comfortable in life, why bother to gamble other than, hey, it's fun or whatever, if you think it's fun. But there are a lot of low-income people who are never going to become rich, who are never going to become successful, and that might be their one chance at success. And I think it's a perfect illustration of the problem. I don't know what people, others are seeing about it, but it's a bad one.
Is there any documentation on what's happening to people that, say, won the lottery 20 years ago and now have gotten their last check? You know, they haven't worked for 20 years. Where are they going from here?
I wonder how, I haven't seen any studies. There weren't enough lotteries. New Hampshire was the only lottery until
Washington. 15 years ago. Almost 20 years.
Almost 20. New Hampshire's been around for a long time, but most of the other states started in early, mid-70s or later. And the one thing we do have very clear evidence of in Minnesota, we've got a good body of research on compulsive gambling. And it's a relatively small percentage of gamblers. I think it's 3-4% who have serious problems with gambling. But when you're talking 80% of the public gambling, and eventually it coming down to 3-4% who have the serious problems. Law student commits, a female law student a couple years ago in Minnesota, Wisconsin, committed armed bank robberies, 6, 7, 8 of them before they caught her. What was a law school near graduate doing? She was supporting a gambling habit. And I've tried to even to start out by getting our compulsive gambling programs, which we do have, probably better than some states, but to try and get them funded by the people who profit from it. At least they can pay for the damage they do. But I haven't seen anything in terms of what it does. I have seen the immediate impact where some people, the ones you think are going to make it, are the ones who, the truck driver, well, I'm going to keep driving the truck because I like it. I enjoy what I do, and it's not going to change me. But the ones who sell everything, who quit their job the next day and they're going to have easy street, you find out how many times they have pretty serious family problems. And it's not the easy street people always envision, but I don't know if anybody else has heard more of that.
Well, one other scary thing in Minnesota is the impact of gambling on senior citizens and people with fixed incomes, because there are free buses in every shopping center any day. Go to Mystic Lake or any other casino that's there, and the at risk that senior citizens are putting their incomes, their security, that's a whole other issue besides the low income folk.
Right.
I mean the abject poor that are trying to make it rich quickly.
And what you just said, I talked this year to some people who work in the Asian Pacific, Minnesota Asian Pacific Council, and particularly in the Hmong community. Exactly what you said, some of the casinos have buses stopping at some of the housing projects in St. Paul. And they had a big stink about that, and the community finally got them to agree not to do it, so they do. Oh, they stop 2 blocks away. People go there, people who are poor. And again, that feeds on our stereotypes as a public. We don't want to help somebody who's just going to gamble their money away. So it hurts in more than one way, and the number of people in the community are getting very, very concerned. How can we stop that? But I think this illustration is a perfect model for the whole issue of how do we build a community conscience and everything. Again, this year, several of these talks, because I know it's happening here in Washington, and a good number of the people at Hogan are Washingtonians or Minnesotans, and we have a stadium issue in Minnesota too, and most of the proposals that have any chance of passing in Minnesota are using gambling revenue to do it. And so you tie in more than one.
About 5% of what they need is coming out of lotteries, and that's coming out of money that had been going to the schools before. So
I think the issue that underlies a lot of the gambling is the whole disparity between the rich and the poor, and how that gap continues to grow. And I think we as a culture are living in denial of that happening. And the gambling is kind of one of our ways of denying it, because I can break out of what's happening to everybody by getting a piece of it myself. And I think maybe where the community conscience has changed is that when we as a nation went through the big Great Depression, I think there were so many people, it was so obvious to a lot of our parents and people in that period of time, that it was obvious that the whole nation, the community, had to do something about that economic situation. I think what happened in the 70s and 80s is that gap got wider and wider, is we have all these other diversions, and I think part of the sense is that we don't recognize what's happening, and part of it may be the the bombardment we have with the media, that at least, you know, 15, 20 years ago, if folks were watching popular culture, they were usually watching the same thing. Now, you know, the percentage of people who even watch the evening news is tiny, because you have all the reruns of Andy Griffith or whatever you want to see. You know, when you have 500 channels available, you know, we have that kind of scattering of the whole public awareness of what's happening. There are very, very few events that people see together, and I think probably, you know, OJ's Bronco ride, and, you know, there's a few incidences that we kind of gather together as a community again, but they're very few, and they're not usually positive experiences together. They're usually the Oklahoma bombing, OJ, or something like that, and so we continue to be scattered and don't realize what's happening to us.
With the last point you made, we have so many things hitting us in the media now. It's not two or three TV channels, it's 80 TV channels in many communities, plus all the internet stuff, plus all the advertising. Everywhere you go, you're hit with media messages of various types. Even in restrooms nowadays, they have these advertising signs. They don't give you a piece anywhere. You're bombarded every direction you look, and everything you hear, you're hit with media messages. And therefore, we have no one place that people turn to. It's not the daily newspaper or the paper of 100 years ago or the two radio stations
or even
of 50 years ago. There is no national source where we all connect. But the other thing I wanted to make one comment on the disparity between rich and poor, and that is that in addition to the fact that there really is this massive gap, which has been growing many fold from where it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. But the other thing is that people don't, not only do they not realize it, but we all think we're middle class. People don't want to be poor or failures, so people down with annual incomes of $15,000, $10,000 a year will consider themselves middle class. And people earning several hundred thousand a year consider themselves middle class. The best illustration of this was, and this is partly being out of touch, a congressman from North Carolina, elected in 94, was quoted in the paper as saying how, you know, that he was middle class. And somebody said, wait a minute. Well, he was lower middle class. And I said, what do you mean? Your congressional salary is 130 some thousand a year, and you told us yourself you had this pension of 50 some thousand a year. That means you've got to be making at least 180 some thousand a year. And yeah, that's lower middle class. Well, what's middle class? Anyone earning between $300,000 and $750,000 a year.
Sign me up.
Which, yeah, we're going to be middle class someday. And so I think people all sense, well, I might be on the, this guy thought he was lower middle income.
Athletes, maybe.
And people, they want to be normal. They want to fit into society, and maybe that's why we see that. But certainly when we have a small percentage, the top 1% now in the United States, 1% of the population owns over half of the resources in the country. They're not earning that much a year, but it's accumulated in such a way that they own virtually half the resources in the country. And that's a wide disparity between rich and poor. And again, the change that you mentioned in the Depression, a third of a nation, ill-fed, ill-housed, ill-clothed. It may have been much more than one third of a nation, and now, since the bulk of us are somewhere in the middle, and not in risking starvation, and where's the next meal coming from, we may not be as concerned or alarmed about it. Anyway, go.
Also, I think looking at it from, you know, an outside, I think there is so much of negativity broadcast, a lot, than when somebody does something that is important, that need to be lifted up, so that people will see that, you know, there is good out there, so other people can imitate. They just say it brief in passing, and that's it. And if it's something evil, it's like they perpetuate it. And when you do that, what you get is evil.
That's a good point. I don't know if others have comments on that. I heard one school group of kids at some high school where there had been some scandal and or some violence or something, and the kids were just angry at the news media. You come here, we have good things happening every day. There's an offense, and you guys are here pouncing on what bad school we are. Other comments on that? Or
yeah, I want to give actually a specific example that still stuck in my mind. I wasn't here when I think a girl was raped by a group of people that the society make a law against rape. I think it was in Iba years and years ago. Where something versus something, long time ago. And about 3 or 4 years ago, they showed that again because they want to repeal that from the Supreme Court or whatever. And so they showed the videotape again. And I sat in the convent room when we were watching the news and I said, why would they show something like this? When it happened, most of the kids now in society weren't born. Believe me, somebody else is going to do it. And within a week, another college, 3 or 4 boys raped 2 girls. And when they arrested them, one put his coat over his head. And I was watching the news and I said, if you feel shy, why did you do it? But you see, it was rehashed again and showed to a community who may not even have had an idea. And so they gave them an opportunity to say, oh, it's something we can do. And they did it. So what I'm saying is that when you get bad things, you know, shown at you all the time, it becomes part of the process. The same thing when you have something good showing at you all the time. If even you are not good, you're bound to be good because you will pick it up eventually.
We want to fit in, you're right. So we see good things happen, we want to fit in. John? Oh.
So.
It's one thing I've been thinking about is how it seems like we've somehow gotten the message that we have to spend money on a lot of different things. And so then we start to panic because we don't have enough to spend it on those. I mean, things like catastrophic healthcare, I'm not sure I'm using the right term correctly, but the way people, when they get, they're getting very old and they're very, you know, frail from something and they end up putting in, you know, $200,000 in their life as expanded 2 weeks or 5 weeks, or, you know, right at that time when somebody, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, would have ended up dying, and we somehow just dump our savings, dump all this money. So now we've got to, as younger people, we've got to be saving up for all these huge expenses, and we feel this weight. And the other things like cars, or things where we have to have a bigger car, a better car, $20,000, $30,000 cars to get us around, and then it, combine that with, it seems like housing is, we're not, just a couple random examples here, but housing is not expanding or increasing. The cost of housing is, the amount that you can sell your house for is not increasing so rapidly, so now people are panicking because they can't, they have to save up to try and sell their house. Or it seems like there's all these money pressures, and that brings out the bad things in people because then they start to try to protect their money or be afraid of spending it for other people because they don't have enough. But some of it seems artificially imposed on us. We don't. I guess I'm seeing it happening too at my office, where we've been told we need to cut back on a whole bunch of money. Now people are starting to defend their jobs and spending half your job trying to defend your job versus doing your job. Or the same kind of thing, you know, housing was going up, so people could always, you could always sell your house in 5 years, you could make, you know, double the price that you get for it, and it just seemed like money kind of came easy. And so, but now it seems like people are still prosperous. I mean, there's still a lot of money floating around the society into people's pockets, but it's, I don't know, there's just this sense that we don't have enough, but I think that's somewhat made up in a way. Panicking, causing people to panic.
Right.
What was the title of the topic again? I was wondering if, you know, this is all important stuff and so forth, but wasn't it something about what is the Has the political process?
No, political the public. No, it was the collapse of the public conscience.
Oh, okay.
I actually gave a talk last week on political confidence, public confidence in the political system, which has obviously gone down as well.
Okay, this is more related to that.
And okay, well, because the.
But where are we addressing?
Go ahead. You can.
No, I don't. Okay, no.
I'm happy to talk about that later too.
The subject a little bit, but no, I don't.
Okay, because somebody had asked earlier about something that sort of tapped into that and the negativity of the political process, but that's not exactly the topic for tonight.
It's difficult for me to imagine that we as a generation are that much more in trouble as a conscience than the generation preceding us. If you read the novels written in the 20s, you know, John Dos Passos or Locking on the F. Scott Fitzgerald. I mean, there were a lot of problems displayed in novels written right after the World War I, that where moral conscience was obviously an issue for the people who were writing those books as they reflected the society they lived in. And I don't think we've changed all that much. I mean, if gambling's an issue now, the only reason it's an issue is because our legislatures have legalized it. And, I mean, that's not necessarily, the legislature reflects what we want. I mean, we lobby, we write letters, we send people into office that do the things that we think are important, and then they do that. And then we get upset when that occurs. I don't know if it's necessarily a collapse of conscience. I think the points are very well made about the public, you know, the publicity that arises, and sort of the inertia that we've developed as a society to make those kinds of changes that are necessary.
I think it's getting worse, but I don't want to oversell that point because there are, as you point out, in the 20s, bad times. I read an article several years ago about eye gouging and backwoods eye gouging in the South in the 1820s or so, 100 years earlier, and how people settled disputes, you know, to get revenge. They would intentionally gouge out the eyes of their opponents in a fight. And how it was a method of fighting in Virginia or somewhere in the South in the 1820s, and brutal things that we'd never stand for. And you can go back hundreds of years and find things like that. What I was trying to suggest is not that people did bad things then, didn't do bad things then, but that in a sense, many times our society has been, we've been trying to move forward and the public conscience, again, not what individuals do or even the sum total of all the good things and bad things, if you could somehow add them all up, that's changing, but that what the public direction is headed as a community and what our goals are for the future, what we envision for the future, what we're trying to build up as a future are changed. And when you said your point about politicians merely reflecting what we want, there's a lot of truth to that. I don't dispute that. And then, yes, people, we want this and we want this. We want lower taxes and we want more for schools and other things. And then we complain about deficit spending. Yeah, we sometimes get what we want from our political process. But the reason in the subtitle I was talking about politicians appealing to the baser instincts is because I do think there's been a change there. I think we do tend to it's political death to talk about taxes nowadays, unless you're talking about cutting taxes. It's very difficult, and in a sense, the government functions on the basis of taxes. And if politicians appeal to one side of our human instincts, the positive side, it pulls us a little bit that way, not a lot. We're not going to fundamentally change human nature because a group of politicians or other people, the church or others, have a positive appeal to us instead of a negative appeal. But there is some truth to the fact that if you pull in a negative way, people move that way or the other way. That is the point I'm trying to make.
I guess I did make the point a little bit. It seems that a lot of public policy maybe two or three generations ago may have been created by, I mean, I'm a white male, but, you know, it's the rich guys. You know, the Spanish-American War is fought because of newspaper circulation problems in New York City. I mean, there are different things that we have done as a society, but if a very small clique of people is making policy, and that small clique has has some sort of common, you know, moral direction, be it good or bad, isn't it easier for society legislatively to take a certain direction than if we have a more open society as we have now, possibly with more voices to be heard, more opinions to be considered before we stumble our way onto the next milepost?
Yes, the answer to that question is yes. I'm not sure we have more voices contributing to our public policy necessarily. It seems to be, in some ways, while there are more voices out there being heard in small ways, a growing number of voices aren't being heard at all by the political system. It's not driven by a group of, though there may be majority white male people in public office, it is a much more diverse body of them, but they're hearing from pressures. They're elected in ways that, talking tomorrow about money in politics, and the money forces driving political agenda very much shut out a whole lot of positions. Half the concerns and half the issues are not even heard from at the Capitol. You take an insurance policy thing versus, if you have it, the insurance company versus the consumer dispute there, and for whichever side is right or wrong, we hear public office from the insurance point of view because they have somebody who's there full time to lobby on their behalf. The consumer on the other side, at least in Minnesota, doesn't have anybody there lobbying for that point of view. So yes, the diverse voices are out there. They're certainly not equally heard in the process, and yes, they never were heard. Sometimes they didn't even have a voice because of race or other things. People didn't have a voice, but I don't disagree with you. The more voices out there, the more diversity of society, the harder it is to have a political consensus. Do we have a couple more minutes if anybody else has other comments? Connie?
I'm concerned about when we talk about the moral conscience, it seems in the past number of years, the more Christian moral conversation that's being picked up out there is from the not a Christian that I'm affiliating myself with, the right-wing conservative Christian coalition. And I mean, if that is what the public sees as the Christian morals,
the moral majority.
The moral majority, mm-hmm. Yeah. Then where are we in that? Because that is not me.
Nowhere.
Where's our voice? I mean, for the people who are concerned about issues like we've been talking about today, the Christian Coalition does not talk at all about world hunger. Bread for the World that I'm active in has approached the Christian Coalition saying, will you work with us on legislation relating to world hunger? They have no interest in it. But it's in the Bible. But they don't want to do it. Their agenda is a political agenda. It's very different than the biblical agenda, in my opinion. But what do you have to say to that?
Jim Wallace and Interfaith Alliance, and there are some other voices out there trying to be heard and saying, look, this is not the Christian point of view, the Christian position. And, somebody once had a bumper sticker, the moral majority is neither, which may summarize some things well about it. But they've clearly... I mean, in our democracy, we're supposed to encourage people to get involved and to be active and to be vocal, and they've done a good job of organizing in recent years. Maybe in many cases, I would say, arguing not as I would hope the Christian community would do, but arguing, appealing to the baser instincts in people. In Minnesota, the Minnesota Family Council, which is the sort of the national affiliate of the Christian Coalition, their number one agenda is cutting taxes. And their concerns, they wanted to make sure you couldn't have any gay couples married. They were going to make absolutely positive about it, even though it was illegal under Minnesota law. They're appealing to fear in people. They're very much appealing to the negative instincts. And yeah, that's not who I am, and that's not what I think the church is all about. And Ralph Reed, the head of the coalition, acknowledged that he was a partisan political activist who supported these things, and then he found religion and decided, well, this fit in very well, and so he was going to keep pushing these things. And whenever people say this is God's agenda, this particular public policy is God's agenda, be very cautious. I like the Doonesbury cartoon in 88 when Pat Robertson was running for president, and there's a picture of a news conference and you don't see Robertson, but he's clearly at the one end of the room and the reporters are all gathering at the back, and you hear the voice from Robertson saying, "Yeah, I've been endorsed by Jesus Christ." And one of the reporters said, "Sure beats being endorsed by the Teamsters." And the counter I like to point out to that is Jerry Falwell in the 60s was very strong advocate of segregation, racial segregation, because the Bible talks about separation of races, and he was for that. And that was God's will and God's position. He was fighting for God. Well, he's no longer in favor of that position. Did God change his position too in the last 20 years? It was just, we got to recognize that I as a politician, you as a politician, we have a faith that's supposed to drive everything we do, and I hope it drives everything we do in politics as well. But it's our positions. The Bible tells us, Richard Neuhaus said, that the Bible doesn't tell us whether we should feed hungry children of the poor with food stamps or soup kitchens or higher minimum wages or AFDC or what, but the Bible does make it clear we're supposed to be concerned about the hungry children of the poor. We as human beings, as partisan human beings, are supposed to fight out among ourselves how we can best accomplish that. What we get from our faith is the guidance on what we're supposed to care about, and then we're the ones who are supposed to plug that in, but got a long way to go in there. Anything else? I think it's about, the hour is about up, but so you can cut off the tape, but we can continue discussing for a few minutes till Vespers if people wish.
That was some of the discussion that I wanted to get into rather than these individual little signs of decadence or whatever.
Well, let's just continue on with that then.
And I think that, you know, it's hard to talk about this and capsulize it, but I think there's been a sort of an unholy alliance of the Christian right. I mean, I'll talk against them from now till kingdom come, because I think they've done us a big disservice sort of forming a bond with, you know, appealing to our more basic natures. You know, greed is one of them. And they've also linked up with the worst parts of the business community. You know, I mean, that is a linkage that we have to point out
because it's very clear.
Yeah, they claim that they're for the small businessman, but it's really big business in most cases. They're really not doing much for small businessmen, or nothing, actually. And in fact, they're going backwards. And the wedge issues, you know, lifestyle issues, the abortion issues, they drive those things for all they're worth. And I think they sit down and they basically, sounds like one of those conspiracy mentalities, but I see a lot of evidence of it, you know, when I go down to the statehouse, because then they've infiltrated the Republican Party, and even though the moderates can't stand them, they can't afford to kick them out, because then they won't have the majority and get some of the agenda that they want, you know. So I think it's really hurt the country, you know. And
by the way, for people who don't know, I don't know your first name, but Representative Anderson from Washington State Representative Dave. I'll echo everything you're saying on the religious right, and it is in very many ways an attempt to be divisive, and this tie with the business community is very clear. They seem to be pushing, if you read the agenda of the ads of the business community political action committees, or PACs in Minnesota, and what they're pushing, it's almost the same rhetoric that the Christian Coalition is using, and they push it hard, and I don't see a lot of the messages I see in the gospel of love and compassion and concern, that's not on their agenda. And if you press them on that, they'll say, well, yes, if we cut everybody's taxes, then families will have more money to decide how they'll spend it instead of the evil government.
Right, right.
But that's the closest they'll come to talking about any sense of compassion or concern for others.
But,
go ahead.
Excuse me, why the country says it doesn't want to be manipulated by religion, why do they then allow the Christian correlation that is going in the aggressive, negative way to have an effect? I mean, it puzzles me. Can somebody answer me?
They've got political.
They're so active, so they probably write more letters and do more contacting than any other group.
Get the people out to the poll, out to vote.
In our system, it's not what percentage of the population favors something. It's what percentage of the population is organized and vocal and votes on those issues. Gun control is a good example. I don't know about here, but in Minnesota, 70-some percent of the public favors some forms of gun control. There's probably 10% of the voters who oppose any form of gun control. There are probably 10% of the voters who vote on the issue of gun control. It's a major factor in who they're going to vote for and against. And at least 9.5% to 9.9% of that 10% are people who vote against anyone who votes for any form of gun control. And therefore, if you're trying to get 51% of the vote, and even though most of the public may agree with you on that, they vote for or against you because of other reasons, and there's 1%, there's one easy way to get that 10% of the vote, which may make the difference. You vote with them. Same thing with the Christian Coalition, whether it's abortion or whatever thing, you toe the line on it. And it was interesting because in Minnesota, the largest anti-abortion organization has gotten, they were tying up every bill, any health care bill, anything else. They had their toe-of-the-line kind of issue that they were going to put on as an amendment, and they got most of the people who agree with them on the abortion issue so angry at them now that they're having trouble losing their credibility because they've overstepped on that. Fred, and then over here.
I was just going to observe that politicians these days, even good ones, the people we in this room would think were good ones, must feel in a terrible bind, like there's this catch-22. If you'd almost have to be crazy trying to get elected without appealing to these baser instincts. Just the dirty campaigning. I live near Chicago, and my God, it's just horrendous what political campaign in Chicago is like. You cannot get elected without just being a sleazebag.
And tearing the hide off your opponent.
And for somebody to step into that and try to go the high road is nuts. So, you know.
I don't think it's so nuts anymore, because it seems like people have gotten pretty fed up with that. And if you do, then people will latch on to it.
Is there some evidence that this has turned against people?
Well, let me put this. We got into this discussion on some other talk this past week. I can't even remember what the topic of the talk was, but we talked about the negative stuff. And the media consultants recognize that the polls say overwhelmingly the public hates negative campaigns, they hate negative attacks, but what they do then is sound as positive they can be in being vicious. You stab them in the back with a smile on your face. And the trick is to look like you're doing it. This last year, one of the many ways this is done was to accuse the opponent of running a slimy campaign. I can't believe that so-and-so is stooping so low as to run these vicious, negative, terrible attacks on me, and on and on and on and on and on. When the other guy didn't do any of that, and this person just keeps accusing him and accusing him and accusing him of it, you're right, the public hates it, they don't want to stand for it, but the media consultants have figured out ways to make it work.
Yeah.
And so, yes, there's hope because the public is angry by it. I've always, in every campaign that I've had control over how media and message was done, I haven't even mentioned my opponent. I talk about, here's what I stand for. And I'm not hesitant to argue. I love debating and have debates with opponent and contrast, things like that. But the cheap negative stuff, no. My one statewide race, gubernatorial campaign, we hired media consultants, and they kept coming up with their own things. We threw out 90% of their stuff, and the stuff we ran, I wasn't pleased with it. I don't think it was vicious, but it still was. It wasn't about what I stood for. And I don't think the public ever got to hear, since two-thirds of the public, at least in statewide races, gets most of their information from TV. I said if I was ever to do it again, I'd do it totally different. And I would set the campaign plan, and you're going to do it this way, or we don't want you to help us, because it was a weird set of circumstances, but it didn't reflect me. And so I've found myself very successful. I've won 6, 7, 8 campaigns talking about what I believe in. And so, yes, I think you can do it. The reason people run the negative stuff is because it works. It's easier.
I was just going to say, getting back to, you know, groups like the Christian Coalition saying this is how the people feel. I don't know how we got on their mailing list, but we started getting questionnaires and surveys from the Christian Coalition. And if you read the questions very carefully, they were phrased to get to respond in the way that they already want it. And I'm sure that's true with other groups. So of course they can say, you know, that all these people feel this way.
Yeah. The so-called Defense of Marriage Act, which Minnesota, like most other states, is doing now. Well, I want to defend marriage too, but I'm not sure how that legislation defends marriage like mine. I don't see what it has to do with it. It's pandering to people's fears of people who are different than them. And you're right, it's the wording of the thing. I don't think the 80% or so who support it would be anywhere near that high if it was called something that opponents might label it, but that's very definitely the case.
Don't you think a lot of it stems from the fact that there's so many issues out there nowadays, it's really hard for folks to keep track of what's really happening on different issues. So they're easily
easily
confused. You know, like the defense of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going to use that big time in the next campaign. I know they are. You know, I mean, I voted against the defense of marriage. Therefore, I don't defend marriage.
Right.
But it was a mean-spirited bill. It was already outlawed in the state of Washington.
Same in Minnesota.
A pure political ploy to use. And you know, but it's going to be very hard for the voters to discern because, I'm totally heterosexual and so forth, but I just wouldn't buy into that. Bigotry is what it was.
That's exactly what it was. And in Minnesota, the Senate the committee chair, I'm not in favor of keeping things off the agenda by ducking the issues, but a Senate committee chair managed to keep it off the agenda, so they put it on another bill. So we were only voting on it as part of a much bigger bill. And so you could easily, anyone who wanted to could find cover. I spoke against it because of the fact that, you know, you wouldn't know where somebody was coming from otherwise. We have one member of the Senate who happens to be homosexual, at least openly, only one. And he spoke in opposition to how he's had how society keeps talking about how the homosexual community is so promiscuous. And he says, I've had the same partner for 15 years. We want to be together. We want to have a long-term monogamous relationship. And they won't let us do it. And I figured if he was the only one, only male legislator speaking out, I figured I better too. But they'll use it against us in the next election, you can be sure. Tomorrow I'm talking about the role of money in politics, which somehow relates to a lot of these things. But thank you for your attention.